welcome to the Possibility Project, an open conversation series where changemakers talk about the big questions we need to answer now. Your hosts are Devin Davey and Heather Hiscox, together with technical help from the nonprofit Snapcast. This series empowers the listener to shift systems, rebuild structures, and foster equity in the social impact sector.
So welcome to Possibility Project. It's a disruptive conversation series where changemakers talk about the big questions we need to answer now. And this is our seventh episode. Possibility Project started in March. We had our first episode in May. And this is our seventh topic, and we have three more scheduled for the rest of the year. So if you're new to this community, if this is the first episode you've ever attended, we give you extra special welcome. Devin's going to put in the chat the link to the YouTube channel, which has all of the other recordings. So we encourage you to check those out and see what other topics you might find of interest. And I'm going to start with introductions. My name is Heather Hiscox, and I use she, her pronouns. And I am on the territory of the Tohono O'odham Nation in Tucson, Arizona. And for those of you that are visually impaired, I am a redhead, freckled, light-skinned white woman with red hair, blue-gray eyes. I'm wearing a black and white striped shirt, and I am in a room with a blue background, blue walls. And we really hope to have the closed captioning set up for this episode, but with technical pieces, we weren't able to make it happen for this time. But for the next episode, which will take place at the end of October, we will have closed captioning for everyone that attends. And I'm hoping to have a full transcript of today's episode that won't be live, but we can share after. So please forgive us for not having that set up real time. So my co-creator, Devin Davey, is a strategy consultant and helps social entrepreneurs, founders, and CEOs get unstuck by co-designing and implementing people and process solutions. And Devin will share information about her organization in the chat, and she'll be monitoring all of the chat. And for the chat, we want it to be lively. We love the amens. Yes, that's awesome. We love the questions, the comments, conversations that happen, commenting on each other's posts. We want that to be a lively, active space. So please keep that going. And Devin will be here to help you with anything that you need. So she'll be putting links, but if you have questions, you can send her a private message and she can support you as well. So I am Heather Hiscox, the CEO and founder of Pause for Change. I work with nonprofit, local government, and philanthropic organizations to help them solve problems more quickly and more efficiently and effectively, essentially what we do. So you can check that out. I'm going to start sharing slides so you can see more about the why behind the work. So you can see that. All right. So here's Devin and I, and you can see us on the chat. We really wanted to transform this moment of crisis and opportunity to forever transform the social sector to be better than what we accepted as normal. And the goals of Possibility Project are to unite a community of diverse change makers, stimulate new thinking and a thirst for deeper change, and explore collaboratively what can be possible. So that's really what fuels this work. I want to talk through the agenda today so you know what to expect. We are going to talk a little bit about the why we chose this topic and why it's important. We're going to hear from our speakers. We're going to have time for Q&A, small group discussion, and then key takeaways. So our speakers are going to answer two questions. What dysfunctions in the sector related to whiteness of social sector do you want to disappear? What's emerging and giving you hope? So they'll have a 4-minute lightning talk that each of them will give. And then they'll have a conversation about what's emerging that gives them hope. We'll open it up to all of you to ask any questions that you have. And then we'll go into breakout sessions. And we hope to have more time, about 15 minutes, that you'll be able to talk to other folks and share your insights and thoughts. And then we'll all come back together to share key takeaways in the chat, ahas and insights, and we'll hear again from our speakers before we wrap up and talk about the next episodes that are coming up. So I want to share a little bit about the why. I'm going to stop sharing my slides here. So the why behind this topic is, it's really important. I'm going to read off some statistics. If you're not already aware, it'd be a great refresher for you. Whiteness and how we think about it is about white power. And white power shapes the work that we do in this sector. 87% of all nonprofit executive directors or presidents are white. Nearly 79% of nonprofit board members are white. 92% of foundation presidents are white. And 83% of full-time staff members that work in the sector are white. And when I say white power, what I'm embedding within white power is white supremacy, white colonial practices of extraction and devastation, white privilege, white saviorism, and white fragility. If you are not aware of those terms, I really would hope you would be, and I hope you do some research on your own to learn about those pieces, to unpack it. But what I'm gonna focus on is Rashad Robinson, the executive director of The Color of Change, has some really great definitions of power. So I wanna situate those in terms of white power, and then our speakers are gonna go a lot deeper. So one of my favorite definitions that he talks about is a definition of power of whether or not people really care about disappointing you. And when we think about this sector, when we think about who we fear disappointing most, we care most about disappointing board members, funders, and major donors. I don't hear a lot of folks in this sector terrified about upsetting their staff who run the sector and about the communities that we exist to serve. And so that's a really important call out, that those power dynamics and the fear that's created is not an accident and it's not incidental. Very important. The next piece he talks about is power is the ability to change the rules. Sometimes the rules are written, like they're written rules of policy, and sometimes they're unwritten rules of culture. And we have a lot of policies and practices and norms that dictate our sector. We have, for example, tax policies and philanthropy that create wealth hoarding dynamics and grow the wealth gap. We have nonprofit tax policies that preclude our sector from fully engaging in political advocacy work and reaping the benefits and rewards that for-profit and corporate entities get to enjoy. We have norms that are really set up as best practices, and if we violate them, there are tremendous consequences around what is philanthropy, what is grant making, what is board development. Those are highly dictated by white norms and expectations. So I wanna make sure we're aware of that. And then the last is the power of narrative. Rashad Robinson talks a lot about who controls the narrative and who controls the stories that are told. And we have a lot of narratives that dominate the sector that were created by white folks for white folks, and the narratives do not serve everyone. And Daryl Lester, who was a participant, he was a speaker on Possibility Project, I think on episode 2, he talked about the narrative that tells Black folks their role within the sector. And he called out very clearly that as he entered philanthropy, he was told, we are the givers, you are the receivers. We are the producers, you are the consumers. And it sets a tone where certain people are the sectors for them. And if we look at that data, we look at those statistics, it makes it very clear. And it sends a very clear message. While on one side of our mouths as a sector, we say we're here to serve. And on the other side of our mouths, we make decisions and we take our actions that say, we will not listen to you. We will not hire you. We will not promote you. We will not elect you. And we are here to serve the greater good. But I would question, what's that greater good? So I wanna just set that tone that this is beyond diversity, equity, and inclusion. This is the core fundamental foundations of how our sector was created and what influences how we operate. So I wanna make sure we keep that top of mind in this conversation about whiteness, because it's very important in how it permeates. So I want now to hear from our brilliant and amazing speakers. And our speakers today are going to share an interesting tidbit about themselves. We don't do the typical intros where we really read the long bios, which are just phenomenal. Devin's gonna post those in the chat, but we want them to tell a little interesting story about themselves, because after all, they're beautiful humans. We wanna have a little taste of that before they jump into all that wisdom. So we're gonna start with Sean, Thomas Breitfeld. Sean co-directs the Building Movement Project. You would most know them for their Race to Lead work and Race to Lead Revisited, and we hope you check that out if you haven't already. So Sean, can you please share, unmute yourself, and share an interesting tidbit about your family that people may not know?
Sure. So I'm not sure how interesting this is, but I'm a double PK, meaning both of my parents are ministers. So like when I say I grew up in the church, I really mean that. And, you know, like I still have a spiritual practice, but I'm not currently a devoted church goer. But, you know, a good gospel song still gets me emotional and things like that. So
I love that, Sean. Thank you so much. So Dr. Lakia Cherry is Chief Executive Officer of the Network for Social Work Management. And Dr. Lakia, I want you to share your fun tale about when you wandered off a little bit off the path and where you ended up.
Okay. Thank you, Heather. Welcome, everyone. So I love traveling. I've traveled to over 35 countries around the world. And a few years ago, I was in Brazil, and I was in this famous park roaming around, and I saw a sign to a path. I love taking photos, so I thought maybe there was a view. I signed some paperwork that was in Portuguese and started along the path. I was in jeans and sandals, and you know, about 30 minutes later, I'm sweating and I have no idea where I'm going. I don't see a path. Then my sandal starts breaking, but I'm so curious that I kept going up further. Finally, I saw someone running down the path and I asked them where the path went to, and they said Christ the Redeemer. I had no idea I was hiking up Christ the Redeemer. So at that point, I had to make a decision to turn around. As soon as I turned around and got to the bottom, my sandals broke. So that was my story.
I'm glad you made it safely back down off of Christ the Redeemer. Andrew Plumley is our final guest, Director of Inclusion at the American Alliance of Museums. And Andrew has a very interesting past with a background in the music industry. You want to share about that, Andrew?
Sure. And thanks, Heather and Devin. There's nothing quite like waking up to a conversation around whiteness, especially for the Pacific Time folks. So in college, me and my friends made a song. It was very much a kind of a satire on the small liberal arts New England school in which we were going to, around, you know, wearing Nalgenes in your kind of belt loops and eating granola and wearing Tevas and all of the things. And that actually lent itself to a production company flying out from LA to make a music video. That got on YouTube, made over 1.5 million views, and it actually it led us to opening up for Kid Cudi, who's a hip hop musician, and a couple different schools for their kind of like Spring Fest things. We only had one song. That's the only thing we did, but it was really quite the experience. So I'm basically a hip hop star at this point. So
I love it. I love it. A man of many talents. It's fantastic. That's great. So we are now going to jump into those lightning talks, and Dr. Lakia is going to go first. And the prompt that we always ask in our first section of every episode is, what dysfunctions in the sector do you want to disappear? And we make it around the topic. So what dysfunctions do you want to disappear related to whiteness in the social sector? Take it away.
Perfect. Thank you. Well, again, it's a pleasure to be in the room with a preacher's kid and a hip hop star. So what I'm going to share are dysfunctions that I've noticed as a Black woman, a social worker, and a CEO of a national organization. So whiteness as norm, especially within the social sector, this is dysfunctional. We're all aware of white supremacy culture, hopefully. We're aware that race is a social construct. So for a sector such as ours that often purports to have social justice values and to primarily work with marginalized communities, for whiteness to be the norm or standard is dysfunctional. So if you see in the bottom, I have today is October 7th, let's do better. So this is hundreds of years later, and we're still dealing with these issues within our organizations, as well as within other systems around the world and our country. Silence and complacency, dysfunctional. So for many years, we've known that people of color, especially Black people, face different odds different inequities within the country. However, it wasn't until George Floyd's murder that many people woke up and weren't as silent as they once had been. For far too long within our sector and others, we've been complacent and we've allowed these things to exist as status quo. We've been aware of the systemic issues, but just because we maybe worked on them within our particular jobs doesn't mean that we shouldn't have greater awareness within our families and do work outside of our typical 9-to-5. Excuses and justifications. So Heather shared some research at the beginning of this talk, and many organization leaders will make excuses, they'll make justifications. Wells Fargo, we recently saw that their CEO made comments such as they're not necessarily being people qualified for different roles. We often hear that leaders of organizations can't find a person of color for a leadership position or another role, but in essence, we need to do better because that's an excuse and it's a justification for poor behavior. No internal work and savior mentality. I've seen this often within my own profession. People come into the work wanting to problem solve and save and correct things that they think are dysfunctional or wrong. But they don't do the work, they don't do the research, they don't understand the systemic barriers that people face and the reasons behind why things are the way that they are. They also don't do internal work. And so they aim to do bias workshops and have conversations about diversity, equity, and inclusion. However, they haven't addressed their own biases. And then within organizations, they aim to advocate for systemic improvements and to protect and serve those from vulnerable communities, yet their board isn't diverse, their leadership isn't diverse, and they're not doing work internally. No diverse leadership. So this one especially hits hard for me. As a woman of color in leadership, I didn't necessarily realize until later on that it was problematic that there weren't many people like me. I was so used to there not being other people who looked like me, being an only or the only person of color in a room, the only Black person in leadership. And so it didn't stand out until a few years ago when the Building Movement Project released their Race to Lead report. Heather quoted the statistics, but especially for a sector such as ours, it's dysfunctional that we have racial leadership gaps within leadership teams as well as boards of directors. Performative statements and acts. Many organizations, not just within the social sector, but also within the corporate sector, release statements over the summer. Some release statements with regards to Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, as well as other racial injustices that has happened this year in our country. This is performative. Where were the statements before? Many people just barely began to understand why Black Lives Matter and to really begin to act as it pertains to these statements. Many book clubs were formed, many Facebook groups were formed, many articles were written, many organizations began all of a sudden doing DEI work. Where was this work before? All of these issues didn't just appear in 2020. They existed for a long time. And so the performative statements and acts is very dysfunctional, and it usually doesn't have data and metrics to back it up. So it's very time limited, and it's not something that is sustainable. Over-reliance on BIPOC to fix systemic issues. So there's an over-reliance on Black, Indigenous, people of color to fix systemic issues. We didn't create the system. The system was not designed for us. So with everything going on in this country, to expect that a person of color within your organization will know what you should do or how you should handle this issue is dysfunctional. They're not the ones with the power and privilege. They're not the ones in the leadership roles. It's something that we can collaborate on and work on together, but to rely or over-rely on BIPOC people within your organizations to fix these issues only adds to the trauma, and usually they're not even paid for this work. And then no investment in BIPOC. And so many Black Indigenous people of color within the sector lack access to resources such as coaching, mentoring, technical or didactic training. They lack access to social capital. And so knowing this, in lieu of the systemic barriers they face, organizations can invest money to support BIPOC staff so that they're getting access to things that they typically lack access to. And in doing so, it will help the pipeline of leaders. It will also help with succession planning as many leaders within the sector are getting ready to retire. But then also it contributes to innovation. It helps the bottom line, and there's other benefits such as everyone belonging and the culture being more whole. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Cherry, so important. On a recent webinar that was on, Edgar Villanueva from Decolonizing Wealth was talking about, when you're talking about lack of investment, only 8.5% of all philanthropic support in the sector actually makes it to communities of color. And if you're looking at the 5% required divestment of private foundations, that's 8.5% of that 5% that's making it there. So you make a super important point. Sean, I'm going to call upon you now to share how you will answer that question.
Sure. So in terms of the dysfunctions that I think need to disappear relate to the sort of overwhelming whiteness and the advantaging of whiteness in the nonprofit sector. The first thing that comes to mind is something that Lakia brought up, which is this mismatch between who holds power in our organizations and who those organizations exist for and are supposed to be benefiting in the community. We know that organizations tend to be serving much more diverse communities than is represented in the board and top leadership. Some of the data that Heather talked about earlier, I think, really illustrates that. And in our latest report in the sort of Race to Lead series, we had a whole section of the report on what we termed the white advantage, where we really tried to focus in on this. This mismatch is problematic in a lot of ways. I think it leads to organizations making decisions that are not actually in the best interests of the community, because fundamentally those with decision-making power don't actually know what would be in the best interests of the community. I think it also plays into some of the pitfalls in terms of the savior mentality, the charity modality instead of seeking justice, those sorts of things. I think another big dysfunction that I think flows from the whiteness of the sector relates to how money also flows in the sector. So, you know, I'm really happy that over the last year, there's been much more focus and discussion about what ABFI and others have termed philanthropic redlining. I think that they coined the term, you know, I think last winter in a report, and then it was used and I think gained a little more notoriety when Echoing Green was able to analyze some of the data around the size of grants of executive directors who had gone through some of their leadership development programs, and saw that even in the portfolio of organizations that were supporting Black communities, that those organizations with EDs who were white were reporting much bigger grants and financial sustainability of their nonprofit organizations than those executive directors who were Black. This has like lasting impacts for organizations and also for communities. But I think particularly in a moment where our nation is having an economic crisis and an economic recession, and so many of organizations, particularly organizations that are providing direct services that have never been more needed in our communities, that tend to have much more of their funding portfolio be dependent on government grants. And then on top of it, we're thinking about like the funding, the biases of individual donors. And then on top of it, the ways that foundations have in an unchecked way invested more in white-led organizations. I just worry that we're facing a perfect storm in the next fiscal year for a lot of organizations that have been much more community-based, community-grounded, and have tended to have people of color in leadership roles who are providing the needed services that their communities recognize and really need and value. The last thing I just wanted to bring up related to this dysfunction in terms of whiteness is that when we looked at the experiences that survey takers reported about, like whether they felt like their organizations, that they had a voice in their organizations, whether they felt like their organizations were equitable workplaces, we saw really big racial gaps between people of color and whites when they worked for organizations that were whiter, when they worked for organizations where very few of the boards and senior leaders were white, but people working for organizations where over half of the board and over half of the leadership are people of color, there were no racial gaps. And both people of color and white folks in our survey were reporting more positive experiences. And it just feels really important to lift up that everyone benefits from more diversity in organizations. It would be great if the money and the resources would flow that reality, especially since funders keep saying that these are the sorts of things that they care about. It just, so far, it doesn't seem like the money bears any of that out.
Absolutely, Sean, so important. And I think the point that you bring up is that, you know, it impacts the daily life. We work in order, we exchange our time for money is how I think about work, right? And where we go and where we want to spend time matters. And if we're going to an institution where we might be experiencing microaggressions and trauma, and we're situated in a sector that is potentially traumatizing entire communities, it's really important to recognize the day-to-day lived experience of folks that are working in the sector that are non-white. And thank you for bringing that up. So now we want to hear from Andrew. I want to hear your response about dysfunction.
Thanks, Heather. I think I just want to, you know, double click on Lakia and Sean on what they've said so far. And I hope I can touch on some of those things as well. But I think the dysfunction for me that I want to disappear during this virus is the sector is, as Sean mentioned, kind of overall broad scale investment in whiteness. And as a collective, we're fundamentally and by design in the sector invested in propping up, supporting, perpetuating, and ultimately trusting this thing that is whiteness. And I see this investment in many leaders across the sector, and it manifests both kind of implicitly and explicitly. And I see it with white leaders and leaders of color, although I think generally Black and Brown leaders are more aware of when and why they might have to be invested than our white colleagues and peers. But either way, there's a large scale investment in whiteness we need to move away from. And we can see it in our theories of changes. We can see it in the questions we ask. We can see it in our frameworks, our programs, in what we were just talking about with our sectors, leadership, C-suite, and boardrooms. And it leads to so many harmful things. And ironically, many of those, it leads to kind of many of the same issues that our own organizations are trying to fix. But I want to really name three things that I think I've been thinking about, especially in the year 2020. And the first is that whiteness doesn't allow, it creates a lack of authentic relationships across race in the sector that are built on trust and vulnerability. And I see this lack of relationships, both kind of in interpersonal relationships across organizations and between organizations and the communities they're partnering with or serving. And obviously, these authentic relationships are, you know, crucial to all of our work. But I see all too often the investment in whiteness creates opportunities for leaders and organizations to make decisions that often lead to actions that are not in alignment with the very values of trust, respect, vulnerability that we need to do our work effectively. I've seen this happen with everything from nonprofits that are least proximate to the issues, thinking they know better than the people they are trying to support, to foundations, like Sean said, not supporting Black and Brown-led organizations at the same rates or the amounts of white-led organizations doing the same work. And I think this investment in whiteness also allows leaders, and I'll say here specifically white leaders, to commit to change without actually changing anything about their organization. And Lakia mentioned this earlier. So in other words, the sector keeps talking about the need and want for change without changing how we operate, how we partner, whose voices we actually listen to, et cetera. And it's like, I was talking to a friend, it's like, I would love to be Michael B. Jordan. I would love to be him, but I don't act and I don't work out even close to as much as he does. So without putting in the work, without like changing my daily practice, there's no reason why I would believe that I could ever be Eric Killmonger. Shout out to Black Panther and Wakanda on that. But like, so it's just, there's such a disconnect between what we want and the, and what we say we value and the actions that we actually do to back that up. And so, you know, I think seriously, I think the investment in whiteness, and especially here, I think whiteness as comfort has allowed for too long small incremental changes in a shifting world that really requires anything but small and incremental solutions, especially right now. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, I think about how I'm personally invested in whiteness, which is a whole session in itself. But at least professionally, I'm invested in a multitude of ways that I'm seeing more and more and more as I continue my work. And the paradigm I often find myself in is that I'm working and supporting white leaders and majority white organizations. And that's not always the case. I'd say probably 75% of the time I'm working with majority white orgs. And so like most of you, I pay my bills by working. So in a weird, troubling way, I get paid to both support and dismantle whiteness at the same time. And that's a hard thing to hold. But I think holding that nuance is needed. And I'll end with, I find myself working from a deficit because of whiteness and the investment in it. I'm finding myself working in a deficit frame in which a leader or organization, or in my latest experience, museums, are like lacking X. It's lacking racial diversity. It's lacking an inclusive culture. It's not producing equitable outcomes. So it's often framed as something people or organizations don't have. And don't get me wrong, this is important work. I love this work. We need to continue this work, and we need to get to a baseline of equity, absolutely. But because of this, we never really get to committing to the important and crucial work of visioning a collective future where there are different types of partnerships, relationships built on that respect and vulnerability and trust, like I was mentioning, or a future where there's both a lot of accountability and a lot of grace. And I think that's kind of getting into more liberatory type work. But again, the sector's overall investment in whiteness prevents most of us to get to have that time for visioning a future for ourselves.
Thank you, Andrew. I'm so glad that you brought up Wakanda, Black Panther. It's something I think about. I think about, what if this sector was centered in Black power? What if it was centered in Blackness and Afrocentricity and plurality, right? What if, can you imagine how different it would be? It would be astounding if that was the foundation from which the sector was created. It's something I like to daydream about and see what could be possible. So I now want our speakers to have more of a casual little chat, and we're going to talk about the good stuff. What's giving you hope? What's emerging that makes you feel like, okay, we're on some sort of track? Who wants to jump in and share those thoughts?
I'll go.
Yeah.
So hope is like a weird word for me right now, because I realize without hope, what do you have? And so I'd say this conversation gives me hope. I was thinking about this topic, and I was thinking about the last year, the craziness of the pandemic and everything else that is going on. And I'm sure most Black people, most people of color are just like, what the heck, and curious and anxious and feeling a whirl of emotions. But I think this conversation gives me hope, because it shows that we are making some progress. I don't necessarily know how much, but when I think about a few years ago, I don't think that I personally would be openly and candidly participating in a conversation about whiteness in the social sector. Maybe with my friends and colleagues who get it, but I think now more people have opened their eyes and they're more aware and curious and able to have these courageous conversations. So this gives me hope.
That's great. That's excellent. Sean or Andrew?
Sure, I'll follow up. I think that I similarly feel some hope in the ubiquity of these discussions. And while I also share the frustration and critique of how performative a lot of this is, and how often inauthentic it is for people to use the right language and frankly police whether people are using the right language but not actually enforce behavior change. As Andrew said, you know, I think that's where the hope is balanced by some frustration. And however, like, I think that that constant like push-pull between hope that the narrative and the dialogue is shifting and opens up more room to put real demands behind seeing actual change happen. My co-director often says, talking about change is not actually making change. And we are getting good at talking in a different way. We are getting good at raising these conversations that had been, as Lakia said, the kind of conversations that we would only have in the side halls at conferences, but now they're the actual topic of the workshop. So that's progress. That gives me hope. And it's like sort of so incremental that I also have like increasing impatience. And I think that that's actually probably good. Like, to that, like, there have to be some of us who are going to continually have, be able to acknowledge some of what's hopeful, but be continually and persistently impatient and dissatisfied with where things are at.
Absolutely agree. Devin and I joke that we started this conversation series because these were the conversations we had in dark corners with our closest friends and colleagues. They were not out there. And with all of the movements and movement work that's happening, like, we're hearing about it, there is flexibility. I think it's so important that we continue these conversations and reinforce accountability. That's something really important to us. Andrew, please chime in.
Yeah. You know, I think for me, my hope is that Lakia and Sean also have hope, because that means we're still with it. We're still working. We're still moving forward together. And I think that I think the fact that many more people really understand the power, or starting to understand the power and necessity of like collective action, I think is my hope. We've seen it on both ends, right? We've unfortunately seen what happens when we're not aligned on values and facts and actions, where with this global pandemic and that we're still in, and what that does to communities and populations. But we've also seen the power of collective action around Black Lives Matter and the uprisings in all 50 states. And, you know, the protests were much more diverse and multiracial than I expected. And I've heard, you know, Lakia mentioned it before, kind of, I've heard the term the Great Awakening, in reference to white people kind of waking up to their whiteness and the racism that's kind of built into the fabric of our society. So I think the jury's still out about the staying power of that real commitment, like Sean mentioned about, you know, I'm hopeful for that. And I'll just say with a quick story. So like, I was born in Texas. I was adopted, moved to Burlington, Vermont, very white state, two white parents. And just in the last couple of months, my father is now openly saying white supremacy culture, using the terms correctly. He's done his work and he's never done that before. And he's 66. So I think that like, there are things shifting. We're getting there. At least we're having those conversations. So that's what I'm hopeful for.
Absolutely. That's great. I have a quote here in front of me, and it says, hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but it is the certainty that something is worth doing no matter what happens. And I love that piece of like, hope has to drive action. It has to change the behavior. We have to work towards it. So we're gonna open it up to questions that that you all wanna ask of our speakers and discuss in this community before we go into breakout rooms. So I would love for you to put those in the chat. One topic looking through the chat is interesting. Ben is talking about reparations. And so I'm curious if any of you have thoughts while we wait for other questions to pop up, if you would be willing to talk about that. What are your thoughts around reparations and how it can be put into play within the sector? Andrew, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. I mean, I think, I guess the way that I'm thinking about it right now is much more, I want us to go through a full process of kind of truth and reconciliation of how we even got here, and then do the restorative and reparative work of reparations. But I think it's needed, but I don't think we can do that without understanding what our investment in whiteness is, so that we can actually deconstruct that and do something else. I think it's absolutely necessary. I think it's necessary in this sector. I think it's necessary for this country. I mean, I think many of us have read Ta-Nehisi Coates's The Case for Reparations, which I think is a really interesting and poignant model for how we could possibly frame a conversation about this. But unfortunately, the way that the sector is structured right now, people at the top in the boardrooms and leadership, I don't think are ready to have that conversation. So I would love to have conversations around how we build enough kind of grassroots and kind of staff-wide kind of collective action so that we can really drive that accountability at the top. It's needed. It's really the only way forward, I think, ultimately. But I don't think leadership is ready to address their own whiteness and complicity in holding down the communities they're actually trying to serve.
Shauna LaKia?
I mean, I think there's so many different proposals around what the framework for reparations would be. And so I think that's part of what makes it a sort of complicated question to apply to the nonprofit sector specifically, because fundamentally, many nonprofit organizations, the reasons that organizations exist is to do some of the work of repairing the legacy of structural and systemic racism, right? So we have organizations that exist in communities that have been created to be poor communities because of policy decisions made a generation ago, right? But those policy decisions were made based on the back of like other decisions that were sometimes actual official policy, other times just like mob rule that led to people of color being sort of corded off into communities that then did not get any investment or in fact were plundered, right? So, and I think that sort of larger systemic issue makes it sort of complicated to sort of talk about like the sector as like a vehicle for reparations. I think that nonprofit organizations can do some work of repairing the brokenness of our society, some work of repairing the brokenness of, you know, how policy decisions get made. But we really have to think about everything. We have to think about the nonprofit sector in tandem with, you know, how corporate structures continue to work to, you know, take advantage of poor people, and how government continues to invest much more in tax giveaways to companies than to the educational, social, and health needs of communities. So I don't want to put sort of so much of the onus on our sector, given how big the problems that the question of reparations relates to.
Yeah, LaKia, do you want to chime in?
No, I'll take another question.
Okay. One of the questions is interesting, and I like this. We're obviously not going to fire all of the white EDs. So how does change happen with a number like 80%? What are we talking about? Two executive directors? You know, what's the path to move forward? And it's a question that we talk about in almost every episode, is around power. You know, do you rip it from people's hands? Do they have to give it up willingly? How do you motivate someone to do that? What does that look like? So, LaKia, do you want to take that one?
Sure. So I don't see the majority of white executive directors turning their position over to a Black, Indigenous person of color anytime soon. However, I do know from what I've read and what I've seen that a lot of our executives are at a point where they're preparing to retire. And so succession planning is something that isn't necessarily prioritized within nonprofit organizations, but should be prioritized. And so if these organizations were truly committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and to having a more diverse pipeline of leaders, then this is something that they can begin preparing for now by investing in their current talent. I mentioned when I was speaking about mentoring, coaching, access to social capital, they can begin doing the work now to prepare someone to succeed them. They also, all organizations can create new roles and titles. It's not something they cannot do. All things can be changed for the most part. And so they can create leadership roles. They can give away some power in that way. So I definitely think there are vehicles for people of color to assume leadership roles, and they can also invite them into their board. Most of our boards are not diverse, even more so than the leadership composition of our organizations. And so if there's not necessarily a role available within your organization, or you just refuse to create one, then perhaps helping bring someone onto a board.
Really great points. Yeah, Sean or Andrew, ideas?
Yes, I agree with everything that Lakia said. I think that it is about recognizing that executive transitions in like this day and age are also often potentially racial transitions. So based on our data, like majority of white EDs took over from another white ED, but a majority of people of color in the ED role did not take over from another person of color. And so I think as we see more current leaders who may be baby boomers and thinking about transitioning into retirement or different way of supporting and leading in their communities as opposed to being executive directors, I think it really is incumbent on current leaders of organizations to prepare their organizations to accept and support the leadership of someone who doesn't look like them. And that involves, as Lakia said, the leadership team, it involves the board, it also involves funders, right? So one of the problems that often happens when a person of color takes over from a white leader is that the organization loses funding because relationships with funders are held by the ED. They're sort of not really about investing in the organization overall. And so, you know, there is a lot of work I think that executive leaders have to do as a part of like planning for a planful executive transition. And recognize, you know, that we have a report on our website that about the leadership in leaving. It is a leadership responsibility to leave your organization in a shape that it can support your successor. And it, for white executive leaders, I think that the work of making the organization able to support and sustain and sort of not make the ED role crazy making and oppressive for the next leader who might be a person of color, it's a lot of work. And I think that work needs to be done.
Can I just say with I think all of the, that's like, that's exactly it. And the, I would just double down the amount of work it takes for an organization with, for the most part, zero capacity to do this, because we've seen that it doesn't actually happen very much, is it takes a lot of commitment to do. And I think I just want to plug this isn't a framework specifically for succession planning, but it is about power and how to share, build, and wield power. And NCRP's power moves speaks a lot to how this actually could work. It's very much kind of community focused, but the framework can actually happen within organizations as well. So I think that can be a reasonable and well-used framework for this conversation.
Thank you, Andrew. Devin, do you see some other questions you want to call out from the chat?
Yeah. Oh, y'all are amazing. This is awesome. I wanna bring up the leadership question around boards. So I think Charlene brought up, and to go a little bit deeper, I think, how do we work with boards who are predominantly white or people or all people of color and are perpetuating white dominant culture in the organization? So maybe we can just specify for you three, like coming from a white board, how do you do things differently? And what have you seen that works? Maybe we can start there.
I think part of what is complicated about the board dynamic is what is it that we expect or rely on our boards to do, right? And part of the reason that many nonprofit organizations end with all white boards is because they're primarily relying on the board to raise money. And given the racial wealth gap in this country, it is completely logical, although not necessarily the moral or sort of right decision, but it is logical that leaders would recruit board members who are rich, right? And if in a local community, the only rich folks are white folks, or all the people of color who are rich are already tapped to be on like five different boards. You know, there can be some limited options. And so I think part of what has to happen oftentimes for those organizations is to reconceptualize the responsibility of the board. Because if part of being a board member is the financial give, and that then creates an actual racial barrier to board service. And so how can boards think about the contribution that people make in their lived experience, in the time that they put in the guidance and support that they provide to the executive director? And a lot of times, you know, people of color who could serve in boards and provide that kind of leadership can actually quantify their time, right? Like they either have the experience as consultants or they're running their own organizations. They can add up, like the amount of time that I spent supporting the board actually is worth X number of dollars, which may be higher than the minimum give for board members that the organization had established just based on like who works at the bank, who can make a big donation. But, you know, so I think that those are some of the things that make, you know, we like to say like, just change the board. Well, as a sort of organizational leader, it's a little more nuanced and complicated than that because of the various incentive structures that have led organizations to end up with the boards that often leaders end up inheriting.
Really good points.
I would add here, I mean, Sean mentioned it, it's kind of the time, talent, treasure, and the shifting of the paradigm of what the board actually could be. But I think from kind of the personal and interpersonal work of specifically majority white boards, it takes a lot of time to move that group in any sort of direction, let alone one that's really going to center racial equity, racial justice, anti-racism, which I don't know many boards that aren't. Actually, I don't know a board that is doing anti-racist work that isn't from a social justice kind of organization. But I think there's three things that I focus on in the programming that I do for specifically white board members, which is building their awareness of what we're actually talking about. And from that awareness, moving to building their capacity around skills to kind of name and address those things. And then finally, after that, moving them to action. Because oftentimes whiteness and the sense of urgency that that brings just says, okay, how do we go straight to tactics? How do we go to action? When really all they'll do is cause more harm because they're actually not aware of what whiteness is, what white supremacy culture is, and how they're actually operating. So awareness to skill building to action is kind of the frame that I try to do with them. But it's a long process.
I love that. Any other thoughts on that topic before we move into breakout rooms?
I have just a quick point regarding that one. So when I first came to the Network for Social Work Management many years ago, my board wasn't racially diverse. And I was a young Black woman coming into a leadership role for the first time, an executive leadership role. But I was so accustomed, like I said, during my 4-minute pitch, that I was so accustomed to being the only one in the room that it wasn't striking to me. And so I just saw them as people with similar interests and values. And I took the time to get to know them and to establish relationships. And one thing I've seen is you often hear what conversations around racism that, but I'm a good person, therefore I can't be racist, and things such as that. It's boards, the people within boards, and the whole concept of whiteness is norm, we need to do better, all of us, at diversifying our networks. And so if you're a social worker, if you're someone working in a nonprofit sector, if you have these values, constantly looking at who you socialize with, who's in your neighborhood, what neighborhood that you choose to live in, who is part of the leadership composition, the composition of your organization, who are your friends, and really paying attention to that. Because one thing I saw with my organization is they said that they have these values. I believe many of them do. But when it came to nominating a board member, it was always a friend or colleague who was always within their circle. But if leadership isn't diverse and leadership is primarily white, that's who's going to be in their circle. That's who's going to be in their network. And just really being courageous and having the conversations like, hey, this is our mission. These are our stated values, but are we really in line with this? One thing that was helpful for us was really having a board matrix where we're looking at the racial composition, where we're looking at the composition by age, by discipline, by sector, by demographics, different things such as that. But then also another thing that we've done is we have GiveGit, but many of my board members, regardless of race, give in terms of sweat equity. And so we do have a dollar amount in mind that most people, especially working in the sector, can't afford to give individually, but we quantify their time if they're doing consulting projects for the organization and other things such as that. And then I see a few comments in chat regarding mentoring and what have you. If you email me, I could give some tips regarding that.
Yeah, Lakia has an amazing project called Changemakers of Color. And what we'll do, a lot of people are asking for resources for where are these statistics coming from and all this great stuff in the chat. At the end of every episode, we will send you a message after for everyone that's registered, even folks that couldn't come live today. And it will have a huge digest of every resource that's referenced, every article with a link, every contact information you would need, anything you need to keep furthering your learning on this topic. So we'll make sure you'll get that within about 48 hours after today. So we want to now transition to the breakout rooms because we want to dedicate 15 minutes for you to talk with others, but I want to talk through some ground rules. We want to recognize that this topic lands differently for different people. And this is not the time to work out your own white fragility issues. I'm just gonna name it. We're centering this conversation in our small breakout rooms about how we're feeling, but we're not dominating that conversation around whiteness in terms of how some of our white folks that might be in the breakout rooms are feeling at this moment with some of these topics, if it is uncomfortable. I just wanna call that out because that can happen sometimes. We want to give space to every person that's in the chat. So if you tend to dominate, step back. If you tend to be a little bit more quiet, maybe step in. You'll have that 15 minutes to share. One of you will be the facilitator. So whoever's first name is closest to the letter Z in the alphabet, you're going to be keeping track of time. You're going to be making sure that all voices are heard and you're keeping everything flowing. The piece that we want to also call out is that what is shared in these breakout rooms is confidential. What is shared by individuals is to stay in that room. When we do the debrief, we'll ask you to share any insights or ahas in the chat. Feel free to do that, but we are not naming names or organizations. We're just saying our group talked about, so it just becomes kind of an open share in that way. And when we return, our speakers will talk about what they discuss in their breakout rooms. They will also go to breakout rooms, so you might end up with some of them. If you do get lost along the way, the internet gobbles you up. I will find you and I will put you into a room. Just give us a moment. And if you need help, just go to the main room and we will assign you to a group. So the rooms are open. I'm going to set that timer for 15 minutes. If you have help, if you need help, come back to us. And we'll see you in 15 minutes to debrief. Here we go.
Thank you for joining us. Please do join us for the next Live Possibility Project so you can take part in the breakout sessions that follow. All sessions are recorded. Please visit possibilityproject.org and connect with us on LinkedIn so we can invite you to meet more incredible impact influencers and make new connections with people who care about what you care about. This has been Possibility Project, produced in cooperation with the nonprofit Snapcast.